Thank you, everyone, for joining us for SPIRIT, the Stimulating Program Initiative for Retirees that Inspires Thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the OU's Department of Community Projects and Partnerships and Coordinator and Host for SPIRIT. The OU started SPIRIT several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it as an online program for retirees, not yet retirees, baby boomers, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, everyone who is looking for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Since the beginning of the pandemic, SPIRIT continues to be the safe and ideal way for everyone to connect and learn together in a virtual setting. Today's program will be a trip down memory lane, as we hear from Yitz Tuckman from Hollywood, Florida, who's been with us before on SPIRIT, and he's going to be talking about Koshrus when I was a kid, records, remembrances, and nostalgia. It is my pleasure and honor to turn the SPIRIT Forum over to Yitz. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you, Reverend Steinig, and welcome, everyone. The story that I'm about to tell you took place some 71 years ago. I was about 4 years old as it began to unfold. I know the story because I lived in the community where it happened, and my father, Louis Tuckman, Alav Shalom, was one of the protagonists. But the full import did not hit me until 2021 when I read a news item on the Jewish News Service. The article recounted how the National Library of Israel had learned that civic records of Jewish communities in Hungary had come into the hands of an auction house in Jerusalem. The library did not want to see the documents fall into private hands, so it took steps to acquire the records in order to make them available to everyone. Our daughter, Aviva, is a key employee of the National Library of Israel. So I forwarded the article to Aviva, thinking it might be of interest to her. As soon as I hit the send key, I realized that I had in my own possession civic records of the Jewish community of Crown Heights in Brooklyn, New York. My father had been the secretary of the Machzikei HaKashrus of Eastern Parkway and Crown Heights, and I had my father's handwritten notes recording the minutes of the meetings that took place between September 20, 1951 and May 9, 1960, 9 years. The second recorded meeting was held on November 29, 1951, exactly 20 years prior to the date of Aviva's birth on November 29, 1971. Yeah, Aviva, I just gave away your age. I immediately sent off an email to Aviva asking if the library might be interested in giving a home to these records. Within minutes, I had a positive and emphatic response, yes. That was in September of 2021. In November of 2021, after a 2-year hiatus caused by COVID, we traveled to Israel to visit Aviva, her husband Yuri, our grandchildren Nava and her new husband Avram. Yes, we missed their wedding. And Binyamin, Kayla, and Gilad. I took the Machzikei HaKashrus records with me, and with permission of my brother, Kalman, I presented them to the National Library. The minutes were recorded on loose leaf paper in a leather binder. I got it right here. The library said that they did not want the binder because they could better preserve the papers themselves by putting them in special archival folders that they use. Interesting, you probably can't see it, but there's the pennant of NYU and the logo of NYU. I assume my father had used this loose leaf when he was in college and later in law school at NYU. I assume that my mother, Clara, safeguarded the binder after my father's death, though I have no specific recollection, it is likely that I found the binder when we cleared out my mother's apartment after her death. I was reminded of the existence of the binder when we unpacked masses of boxes that we brought to Hollywood from Brooklyn when we moved here in 2012. But it was not until the news article in 2021 that I finally sat down to read the contents of the folder. And that is when the memories started flooding back. So, what was the status of kashrus in Brooklyn in the 1950s and the 1960s? I cannot speak with personal knowledge about the early 1950s, but in the years beginning with the mid-1950s, I do have distinct recollections about what I saw in my parents' house, about what went on in the elementary yeshiva that I attended, the Yeshiva of Eastern Parkway, about the merchants who catered to the Jewish households in the community, and about the practices of the synagogues and shuls that supported kashrus. Understand that while the OU and other kashrus supervisory organizations may have existed, they were hardly as active and as vibrant as they are now. And the kosher lifestyle of that era was a shadow of what we now experience. I recently heard an expression that captures how my mother and her contemporaries identified kosher products: label reading. If an ingredient list showed pure vegetable shortening and no lard, it was acceptable. One of my favorites was FFV vanilla cookies. By the way, FFV stands for Famous Foods of Virginia. Not too long ago, I learned from a friend that I had made here in Florida, Stan Frohlinger, that his sister-in-law's mother was a mashgicha, a kosher supervisor at FFV. I don't doubt Stan or his sister-in-law, but I am certain that the FFV label in the 1950s had no indication that the products were kosher. Label reading was what brought FFV lemon thins into my mouth. The tuition at the Yeshiva of Eastern Parkway included hot lunches. I remember seeing cases of surplus butter and American cheese received from the United States Department of Agriculture being packed into the kitchen. I speak with certainty when I say that these dairy products, while free, bore no kosher certifications, and they absolutely were not Chalav Yisrael. On the other hand, I do remember that at some point, the single-serve milk containers were J&J Chalav Yisrael. There were no exclusively kosher supermarkets then as we know them now. Here in Hollywood, we have stores that are absolutely kosher. There are no non-kosher products in them. We have The Grove, we have KC Market, we have Sylvia's, and we have Aroma. Well, back then, no Grove, no KC Market, no Sylvia's, no Aroma. My mother and her friends shopped at A&P, Wallbaum's, Key Food, and the like, and they patronized, they did their shopping by relying upon label reading. There were mom and pop groceries in the community owned by Orthodox Jews, but even in these stores, we could find non-kosher products. The Agriculture and Markets Law of New York State required the posting of placards that declared kosher and non-kosher food sold here. The two local Jewish groceries that we frequented prominently displayed the sign. I remember complaining to my mother after she sent me to the grocery store to buy a pound of cottage cheese, which was dispensed from bulk container. The customer before me had purchased salami that had been hand sliced by the merchant. The salami might have been kosher, I truly don't remember. But I was outraged that the grocer, an Orthodox Jewish man, went from that customer to me without washing his hands or the counter. The butcher stores were also mom and pop operations, as were the fishmongers. Trust in the reliability of the vendors was largely based upon their personal reputations. Reliability was upgraded by the advent of the Machzike HaKashrus that was organized to supervise the butcher shops, but butchers only, not, I believe, the fish stores, and certainly not the restaurants. By the way, the butchers sold basar kosher. I say that to make it clear that the demand for glatt kosher was not yet in vogue, and it likely was not even available. When I was studying for my master's in American Jewish history, I heard from one of my professors, Rabbi Hyman B. Grinstein, that some unscrupulous butchers would emblazon their storefronts with the Hebrew words, basar, basar. This phrase translates to meat, meat. The fraudsters hoped that their customers would be taken in and not see the substitution of a letter bet for a chaf in the word kasher. Their ploy was that if caught, they could argue that they did not represent the status or misrepresent the status of their meat, for they had advertised meat, meat, not kosher meat. To the best of my recollection, there was but one deli in the neighborhood that was owned by a Shomer Shabbos family who had a legitimate claim to running a reliably kosher establishment. I believe that a branch of the family produced a son who came to be known as Professor Alan Dershowitz. There were one or two dairy restaurants that were deemed to be acceptable only because no blatantly objectionable foods appeared on their menus. No meat and no shellfish, but they were open on Shabbos. The major shuls that came together to organize and support the Machzikei HaKashrus included Congregation Chavvei Torah, the Orthodox shul which my family attended, the Young Israel of Eastern Parkway, Orthodox, the Brooklyn Jewish Center and Temple Petach Tikva, both conservative, Yeshiva Rhinus, a large Orthodox shul with a significant after-school Talmud Torah for public school children, and Crown Heights Yeshiva, an Orthodox day school. I found a few other shuls named in the archives, but I have no recollection about them. The president of the Machzikei HaKashrus, Mr. Leon Scheffler, was also president of Chavvei Torah. My father also served in dual roles as an officer of both the Machzikei HaKashrus and of Chavvei Torah. It was at Chavvei Torah that the Machzikei HaKashrus found its physical home. A momentary aside about Chavvei Torah and Mr. Scheffler. Chavvei Torah was sometimes called the Murphy Shul, supposedly because in the early years, before the construction of its magnificent edifice, the services were held in the back room of Murphy's Bar. It was to Mr. Scheffler, sitting on the bima, that I went every Shabbos to offer my hand and good Shabbos wishes. In exchange, I received a Tootsie Roll. I suspect that the treat did not then bear the OU that it does now. The central cog in the operation of the Machzikei HaKashrus was its single mashgiach, Rabbi Chaim Okrangli, who later changed his surname to Ben Zev. The minutes referred to Rabbi Okrangli through May 9 of 1955, and in minutes of meetings later than that, they referred to him as Rabbi Ben Zev. I knew this man by his new surname, by his kindly and modest demeanor, and by his history. Rabbi Ben Zev had been a student at the Mir Yeshiva. He He was among those who survived the Holocaust by escaping to Shanghai. I found him listed in a history of Brownsville as follows: Rabbi Chaim Aryeh Okrangli Ben Zev, Rav of Chevra Ein Yaakov Anshe Skolia, Brownsville, New Brooklyn. Brownsville was a neighboring community. I had no idea that Rabbi Ben Zev held that position. I always thought that his service to the Machzikei HaKashrus was his sole employment. The minutes reveal nothing about the nature of Rabbi Ben Zev's routine. My impression is that he paid visits to the shops of the certified butchers, inspecting the meat and poultry to determine where they were sourced and to check on the process of kashering, that is, soaking and salting the product. The letterhead of the Machzikei HaKashrus lists by name the rabbinic and lay leaders, but surprisingly, not the name of the Mashgiach. It was recorded in the minutes of the meeting of November 29, 1951, that the Mashgiach had requested a raise of $5 per week. The minutes of the meeting of January 24, 1952, reports that Rabbi Ben Zev had been granted the raise, increasing his weekly pay to $80. That would be about $875 in today's dollars. It was also noted that the organization owed Rabbi Ben Zev $215, that's in 1950s dollars, for vacation pay that he had not yet received. I found mention of another pay raise in May of 1956. The amount of the second raise was not specified, but to cover the increase, the weekly subscription charge to each butcher shop enrolled in the program was increased from $2 per week to $2.50 per week. Just think on that for a minute. An annual cost of $130, that's $130 to be certified as kosher. In current dollars, that would be somewhere in the vicinity of $1,375, maybe $1,400. I suspect that it costs a lot more to be certified by an organization such as we have here in Florida, in South Florida, KM or the ORB. I found a few detailed statements showing the financial health of the Machzikei HaKashrus. One of the statements, running from October of 1952 to August of 1953, reported income of $4,474 and disbursements of $4,459, resulting in a closing balance of $15. How did the Machzikei HaKashrus fund its operations? The minutes reveal that in addition to the fees paid by the butchers, there were two fundraisers: an annual concert featuring the chazanim of the participating congregations, and from time to time, a Malavan Malka that was held, but not annually. Tickets for the concerts were sold by the congregations and by the butchers. In 1959, each ticket cost $1.50. After expenses, including signage, advertising, and $90 paid to a professional choir, the concert netted $649. The 1960 concert didn't do so well. It netted $569. Not much is revealed about the Malava Malkas in terms of finances or where they were held, but there is mention of the individuals who worked on the project and that one Malava Malka was tendered in honor of Leon Scheffler, the long-serving president of the Machzikei HaKashrus. If my count is correct, some 18 butcher stores were supervised. Butchers in compliance were given the privilege of displaying a sign showing that their stores were under the supervision of the Machzikei HaKashrus. It seems safe to assume that non-compliance would result in the sign being pulled with attendant serious adverse publicity. When the certificate of kashrus and supervision, that is the sign itself, was redesigned in 1952, the butchers were charged $3 for each new sign. I found no mention in the archives of enforcement or penalties imposed for infractions by butchers. Perhaps there were none, or perhaps the organization chose not to discuss such issues publicly. Though not recorded in the minutes, my brother Cal recounts an episode that he remembers and that could have been in a TV cop show. It seems that Rabbi Ben Zev had suspicions about one butcher shop, but he had no evidence. To scratch his nagging itch, Rabbi Ben Zev mounted a lone nighttime surveillance operation. Early one morning, while everyone was tucked in bed, Rabbi Ben Zev saw a car pull up in front of the butcher shop. From the trunk of the car, sides of beef were extracted and whisked into the store under the cover of darkness. Rabbi Ben Zev confronted the smugglers, demanded to see the meat, and discovered that they had no plumba, the metal tag that should have been attached to the meat, attesting to its kashrus. We do not know, but we assume that the butcher was held accountable in some way. I like to call this the story of the great rabbinic stakeout, or the day the steaks got taken out. The one specific episode that is recounted in the minutes concerned a butcher named Katz, who surrendered his sign, reasons not given. But later, Katz regretted having done so. During the very first meeting contained in these archives, the issue was debated. The first proposal was to surcharge the butcher $50 and to suspend his right to display the sign for 3 months. It was then suggested that the penalty be only $25 and that the suspension be reduced to 2 months. In the end, it was decided that Katz would be required to pay the $25 penalty if he wanted his sign back, but there would be no suspension. Earlier, I described the personal history of Rabbi Ben Zev, the Mashgiach. It is appropriate to talk about the congregational rabbis who steered the Machzikei HaKashrus. In alphabetical order, they are Rabbi Jacob Avigdor, born in 1896, was the chief rabbi of Drohobycz and Borislav, Poland, from 1920 until the Nazi occupation. So understand, he became the chief rabbi at the ripe old age of 24 years. In his capacity, in 1939, Rabbi Avigdor officiated at the wedding of Menachem Begin. Rabbi Avigdor was a noted posek and author. After World War II, Rabbi Avigdor emigrated to Brooklyn, New York, where he served as the rabbi of Congregation Chavevei Torah for 6 years. And that's who I remember as my first rabbi. After leaving Chavevei Torah, Rabbi Avigdor accepted the position of chief rabbi of Mexico City. Rabbi Joseph M. Baumel was the principal of Crown Heights Yeshiva, an Orthodox co-ed day school, and the rabbi of the school's synagogue. I found reference to Rabbi Baumel in an article written by Rabbi Norman Lamb in praise of Drush or homiletics and in praise of the Darshanim or rabbis who excelled at it. The piece appeared in the RCA Sermon Anthology in 1986. It turns out that Rabbi Baumel was Rabbi Lamb's uncle. Rabbi Abraham P. Block was a musmach of Reitz, the Rabbi Isaac Elfanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University. Rabbi Block served as rabbi of the Brooklyn Jewish Center, and it appears that Rabbi Block previously served as the rabbi of Petach Tikva, the other conservative synagogue that supported Machzikei HaKashrus. Rabbi Harold M. Kanatovsky, the rabbi of the Young Israel of Eastern Parkway, was also a musmach of Reitz. According to an article that I found in Detroit Jewish News, reporting on his appearance as a guest speaker at the dinner of the Young Israel of Detroit in 1947, Rabbi Kanatovsky graduated from Yeshiva University in 1944, was a Talmud of the Rav, taught mathematics at YU's Talmudical Academy, a high school, and was a Rosh Yeshiva of the Brooklyn branch of Reitz. I did not know that there was a Brooklyn branch of Reitz. Perhaps the article was referring to the Jewish studies curriculum of the high school known as BTA. I do know that Rabbi Kanatovsky was my Rebbe during my senior year at Yeshiva University High School for Boys, the name that replaced Brooklyn Talmudical Academy. Rabbi David Lifshitz, born in 1906, received smicha from the Mir Yeshiva and became the Suwalka Rav in Poland, serving in that capacity until the Nazis captured the city in 1940. After a harrowing escape, Rav Lifshitz made his way to Chicago around 1941. In 1944, Rabbi Samuel Belkin invited Rav David to become a Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, where he taught for nearly 50 years. I remember Reb David from the years he served as the rabbi of Chovevei Torah, my second rabbi, and especially because of the tzitzis check that he would perform by patting the backs of the boys who were old enough to be mekayim the mitzvah. Though my years at Yeshiva College and Reitz intersected with Reb David's tenure, I was not one of his talmidim. Circumstances and the powers that be at the yeshiva assigned me to other great rabbeim on the Reitz faculty. Rabbi Julius Novick was rabbi of Yeshiva Rhinus. That's the yeshiva, the shul that had the Talmud Torah for public school students. I found little information about Rabbi Novick other than a reference to his support for public funding of Jewish education, a concept that is just now coming into the fore. I do clearly remember Rabbi Novick because the building that housed Yeshiva Rhinus was used as an annex by the yeshiva that I attended when space in our own building ran out. These Torah personalities are of a generation that no longer exists. They were not only learned, they were dignified, and they exercised an exquisitely high level of rabbinic demeanor. The synagogues are also gone. The buildings on Eastern Parkway that house the Brooklyn Jewish Center, Chovevei Torah, and the Young Israel are now in the hands of Chabad. Temple Petach Tikva is now a church. The names of the institutions and personalities that are found in the minutes made me wax nostalgic. Permit me to mention two other personalities who reappeared for me as I read the archives. Abe Mazursky was the butcher from whom my mother bought. Mr. Mazursky was imposingly big in stature, but gentle and soft-spoken. My recollection is that Mrs. Mazursky and his wife survived World War II by fighting in the forests alongside partisans. My mother would often send me around the corner to the butcher shop. I remember being gently lectured by Mr. Mazursky that it was disrespectful for me to refer to my mother by employing pronouns, as in, she told me to get a pound of chopped meat. Better to say, my mother told me to get a pound of chopped meat. Chazan Michael Engelman led the davening at Chavivei Torah during the years when I was learning how to follow along. Chazan Engelman was a bit of a novelty because he wore Hasidic garb. I remember that he has had a son about my age who could run davening circles around me. To this day, in my view, the only appropriate tune for Hallelujah Hashem Kol Goyim in Hallel is the melody that I heard from Chazan Engelman. In closing, one more reminiscence that will perhaps reveal more about me than anything I have said so far today. One of the butcher shops under the supervision of the Machzikei HaKashrus was located on Albany Avenue at the corner of Lincoln Place, around the block from Chavivei Torah. Customers entered the butcher shop through the main door on Albany Avenue. Around the corner on Lincoln Place behind the butcher shop, there was a heavy metal door that gave access to a vusht fabric. For the uninitiated, that is a vusht factory that made salami, bologna, hot dogs, and other delicatessen. The factory was operated by the Hagler family under the brand name Choice National. Ultimately, Choice National became the smokehouse for Shmuelke Bernstein. The factory was a wholesale operation only, but because of my father's service to the Machzikei HaKashrus, we were allowed to purchase retail quantities at wholesale prices. Even as I say these words, the sights, sounds, and smells of the factory are almost as real as they were nearly 65 years ago. Two special recollections. We bought the rejects, the salamis with casings that had split open during the smoking process. To me, they were not only cheaper, I thought they tasted better. And because I came to understand that the Frankfurters were fully cooked when they emerged from the smoker ovens, some of them would disappear during the 3-block walk from Lincoln Place to 1568 Union Street, where we lived. So what became of the Machzikei HaKashrus? I don't know. My family moved out of Crown Heights in 1965. An internet search revealed no record of either the Machzikei HaKashrus or a successor organization. One can only assume that changing demographics led to the Machzikei HaKashrus just fading away. Thank you for the privilege of your time and attention.
Thank you so much. You gave us a fascinating description of everything. And I think so many of us can really, you know, focus and remember, you know, from our childhoods and where we lived, you know, what Kosh was like. Certainly very different than it is now. Let me see. There's one comment. You'd see if you have anything. Oh,
I do.
Not a question, just a compliment.
I have something that is amazing.
Okay.
I am the daughter of Rabbi Ben Zev. Thank you for your enlightening presentation and for your beautiful on-the-mark portrayal of my beloved father. I remember his very warm friendship with your father and the names Louis Tuckman, Mr. Scheffler, and of course, Rabbi Tzvi Dov Kanatopsky are etched in my memory from childhood. My father was selfless and dedicated, as evidenced by the story you told. I look forward to sharing the recording with my siblings. May our beloved parents have a lichtika gan eden, and may their precious neshamos have an aliyah as a reward for their devotion to Klal Yisrael. Thank you again.
Beautiful. Wait, something else is here?
It's Yudis. I apologize. Let me put it to you this way. The Ben Zebs lived in Flatbush, in Midwood Flatbush, near us. We lived on Avenue L and East 10th Street, and they lived on East 7th Street between K and L. So we did bump into each other as adults, but I'm sorry. Otherwise, you just thank you for contacting me. It's amazing.
Okay, here's another complimentary comment. Thanks for such an interesting presentation, and Yasher Koach to Rabbi Tuchman for saving and depositing these important historical records. We at Yeshiva University Archives have several collections of individuals and organizations documenting aspects of kashrus in the early 20th century in the United States, including records of what eventually became the OU, which they have consulted. They're always looking for surviving collections. There'll be a contact there. Oh, there's a question. Did your father, Aleih Shalom, have a connection with the Lower East Side, specifically with the Mizrahi of the Lower East Side? It's the name that this individual is mentioning. It's a name that this individual remembers. So
I know that my father's family originally lived on the Lower East Side. Sheriff Street comes to mind. But I think that, thank God, my grandfather and his siblings all prospered as house painters, and they moved up and out from the Lower East Side to Brownsville pretty early on. So I suspect that my father, I don't know for sure, but I suspect not.
So it's interesting with all the different names that you mentioned and their connections. So when you said Reb David Lifshitz, our Masada Kedushin. So it was like all these different things. I'm sure everybody took a little piece of this and took it so personally. Beautiful. Thank you so much. Any other comments that you have or questions? I don't see anything else here.
Nope, I don't see anything.
Yeah. So we want to thank you so much. Next week, we will be having an inside story on the Jewish response to the Ukraine crisis. And that'll be with the head of our Department of Community Projects and Partnerships, Rabbi Simon Taylor. So you'll be getting that information in the recording today. And you are welcome, of course, to share the recording with others, although we would love to know who you're sharing it with, if you could possibly tell us. And it will be archived probably in a couple of weeks. Well, I'm also happy to tell you that except for last week's program, which is yet to be archived, the archives are now, as of last night, up to date through the end of June. So if you've missed any programs or you want to see something again, you are, always free to enjoy the archives. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Yitz Tuchman, for such a wonderful, wonderful presentation. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Have a great day and have a good week, and be safe and healthy.